Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hello everyone, and welcome to the History of Anglo-Saxon England, Series 2, Lordship, Landscape and People, Episode 2.8, A New Landscape. Last time we heard about something we might gather up into the catch-all phrase of seigneurialisation, a very European-wide process as it happens, where royal land ended up in the hands of private citizens. Privatisation, you might call it. In the English idiom, the process was driven by the needs of the Viking Wars, resulting in a highly efficient, centralised Anglo-Saxon state, which was able to take action to mobilise resources to respond to that challenge, increase the income of geld in particular. The old vast shires and multiple estates became broken up, and much of the land passed into the hands of lords who were often resident on their estates. They took more of their estates in hand, managing them directly and farming them as demesne or inland. They increased the demands they made on the land and the people who worked there, bringing more land into cultivation, increasing rents and dues, above and beyond the traditional fiorum and boon days demanded of the churl since time immemorial, a process that is called intensification, generally. And they create their own little world, their own little universe. They often took control of the church, bringing the priest to live in locally, rather than far away at that distant parochial minster, and trousering part of the church got while they're at it. Life for ordinary people became very much focused on smaller estates and a smaller world around that church and hall, a process of localisation. So, privatisation, intensification, localisation. While all this is going on, the commercial economy is growing too. The growth of emporia came first, the early wicks, and the largest become manufacturing centres as well, York, Ipswich, Norwich, Westminster, Southampton. The 31 Wessex burghs add a massive step forward, and West Saxon conquest of Danelaw another, as the idea of those burghs are taken across England. With growing towns and growing numbers of towns comes a much stronger, more commercial, cash-oriented economy too. Population is growing at the same time. Estimates of English population by the mid-11th century are now about 2.5 million. Today I am going to talk about one of the ways in which many communities react to all of these changes, which will have a spectacular and lasting impact on a substantial part of the English countryside and how it looks. If you know the English countryside well, you will know that there are a few fault lines in the way that it looks. There are some very obvious things. So in the west and north is the preponderance of highland, granite, rather than chalk. And these areas will not change much over this period. They will remain more likely pastoral than arable as a general rule, with dispersed settlement patterns. There are some quite specific areas then, such as the swampy fens of the Humber, the Somerset Levels, and most famously the fenlands of East Anglia. There's various types of coastline and so on. Fine. But there's one which is less obvious until someone clever pointed out to you, as someone clever pointed it out to me. I tried not to faint. And it concerns lowland England, maybe two-thirds of England, I'm sort of guessing. So there's a map in the PDFs on the website, by the way, to help. Page 46, this one. Said map shows two types of lowland England. In the vast swathe across central England from Dorset in the south and west, through Hampshire, Oxfordshire, up to the Midlands, the Vale of York and Norfolk, is an area that has come to be called planned countryside or champion land. I'm going to go for the latter, for champion land, partly because it brings back happy memories of George Formby and his ukulele, partly because I just like saying champion, but mainly because it's more descriptive. The word comes from the French campagne, for countryside of the open, rolling, big sky variety. So, you've got that big strip of champion land, and then you'll see two wide strands on the map, one to the west and north, and one big swathe to the southeast of that central strip. This is called ancient countryside. These two types of landscape have very different characteristics, which you can see as you walk around them, and it is from the 9th to the 13th century in which they are forged. In champion land, you will tend to see nucleated villages of the type that fill picture postcards along with hollyhocks and that sort of thing, houses crammed together, very often church and manor house slap bang in the middle. There might well be isolated farms around in the countryside, but on inspection, it turns out that they tend to originate in much later times, from the 18th and 19th century, so they've been added later. There are relatively few local roads in the area, and where they exist, they tend to be straight, and they're roads with a purpose. They go somewhere specific, like a town or another village. If you're a walker, you might struggle a bit. There are fewer of those fantastic footpaths that are also part of England's glory, and you might struggle to do a circular walk without using a metalled road and fighting the cars. The hedges are straight, and a lot of them are very narrow and rather weedy. There's less woodland, unless they happen to be big, focused bits of woodland, so a bit like a forestry project or something like that. I have a map in the PDF, page 47, of part of the Benson 100. So on the left-hand side of the map, the western bit, you can see what I'm talking about. Not much woodland, straight roads, big fields. But on the right-hand side of that same map, up in the Chiltern Hills, if you look very carefully, it's all very different. This is ancient countryside. There are loads of wiggly roads, some of them aggressively pointless and duplicating. Lots of twisty paths going all over the place, brilliant for walkers, plus a deal of them that seem to have very little point. You will find some very ancient sunken lanes. There's a mixed economy of pasture, arable woodland. The hedges are sometimes really thick. And settlements quite different too. I mean, yes, there are villages with churches and halls, but there are a load of old, isolated, tiny settlements and hamlets. Everything is much more dispersed. So this is a fundamental difference which has been long recognised, actually, as far as back as folks like John Leland, the 16th century antiquarian, who set out to record the countryside that was part of him and which he, like me, loved. The ideas, though, about how that happened have been refined and built on by many more recent historians like W.G. Hoskins, Oliver Rackham, Richard Muir. Plus, I've had two more recommendations since the first time I wrote this episode. Timmy recommended Nicholas Crane and his History of the British Countryside, and Gavin recommended books by Tom Williamson. Now, look, I am an utter novice and so in the starry-eyed acolyte phase. But I cannot tell you of the pleasure of walking around some corner of England and being able to decipher some small clue about how previous and possibly ancient generations lived and shaped my landscape. I am not saying this characteristic is restricted to England, far from it. It's just that this is where my ancestors lived. Now, as it happens also, our South Oxfordshire example, which I have been using, is a rather good place to spot the difference between planned and ancient countryside, because the Oxfordshire Plains are good, strong, classic Jumpian land to the west, where as soon as you go up the Scarp, you're back in a different world of largely ancient, unplanned countryside to the east on the map we're using. I've also, by the way, posted some pics of a couple of villages, as I will explain later. Anyway, so that's the overview. Whence, gentle listener, and I say again, whence? How did this all happen? So, back to our medieval peasants and lords then. First, the lord. Saliva dripping from reddened fangs.
More. Give me more. Ever more.
Obviously, you'll be delighted to hear me trading in crude stereotypes. Can't get through the day without a crude stereotype, so cut to peasants. Into a huddle go our brave peasants to try and deal with the demand from this reddened lord. I say, gather round. Now, look, no point beating around the old bush. We need more chaps. The Thane has made it quite clear. And anyway, we'd like to be a little better off too. So how are we going to do this? Any ideas? Speak up there. Lots of murmuring until they come to this. OK, how's about this then? The problem at the moment is that we all have our individual little fields. They are not always well designed for ploughing anymore with such big teams, especially on the heavier soils we've started cultivating. The fields are too small and square, and there's lots of wasted space, since turning a plough on a team is a difficult process, and all those hedges are unproductive if we're talking about arable here. Also, we've been quite inefficient in the kit we use. There's quite a lot of duplication going on. Everyone's doing their own thing. So here's the idea. We put a lot of our land together into big, shared open fields. We dig up most of the hedgerows so that they're all open and easy to use for big ploughs. Each massive field, can I drop the accent now? Each massive open field will be split up into long strips and handed out to each churl, so that every person ends up with exactly the same amount of land they had before they put it into the pot. It's just that now all their land is split up into these strips. Strips will be distributed all over the place so that it's fair, so that everyone has a mix of land, good and bad. We'll use really long strips as long as we can so that we don't have to turn that ruddy great long plough so much. And then we'll rotate these big fields every 2 or 3 years with animals grazing on the stubble of the field left fallow so that we can feed our livestock and manure the land and let it recover. Plus, while I'm on it, these long strips can be built up into ridges a bit, so they increase the surface area under cultivation and drain into furrows between them. Let's call it ridge and furrow. Result? We need fewer ploughs and oxen for the same amount of land. Labour can be focused. As a result, we can plough more land, produce more arable, generate more income, lower costs, just by pooling our resources. Alles klar? Now look me in the eye and tell me this isn't an idea of some genius. Go on, just do it. And while we're on it, having everything together like this will make it easier to share jobs, materials, become experts in particular skills, and most of all, plough teams. While we're on it, there is another aspect here. We can share rights over our other resources, woodland, meadow, pasture, to make them go further too. We can make this land with common rights on it. This will help pasture the animals during the winter when we're growing cereals, help us cultivate more arable land. What do you say, friends? This is, of course, the famous open field farming system about which much has been written over the years. It used to be thought that it arose from a fundamentally different culture and philosophy, a community-based culture, which got sociologists terribly, terribly excited. But there has been enough poo-pooing of that theory to produce a quantity of manure that would cover the largest of open fields. Historians have pointed out that the development of the practice to any large extent starts far too late to explain it as a basic cultural impulse. So this carries with it the redating of this whole affair, because it was once thought that rather than the 9th to the 13th century, the practice was brought over by the Germanic tribes and could therefore date back to the 1st century. But that is part of the general poo-pooing. It's now thought unlikely now and much later. It's also been noted that the rise of the open field system of agriculture, which will come to occupy fully one third of English land, was by no means as complete or as homogeneous as once thought. So, when I were a lad, for example, this was what was basically taught as how every medieval peasant lived when I was in primary school. In practice, everything would have been much messier. Many more local variations, tweaks and wiggles and whistles and bells. For example, it could be that farmers originally might not have committed all their lands to the general pot and held some back. People would still have smaller fields, some closes, for example. Also, the idea of common land is often overstated. The figure of Denis has been invoked. The idea of an anarcho-syndicalist collective as some kind of pre-communist communism where the community all owned the land in common. Such is not really the case with common land. Common land was owned by a landowner, a particular family or person. What common land really means is land with common rights over it. So it was essentially a right to share some aspect of the land rather than shared ownership. So, Baggins here, he would own the land, but Proudfeet and Sackville Baggins would have some stints on it. A stint is a defined and restricted right of access. It might be, for example, a stint to graze 2 cows for 3 days a week. Just for example, a stint. An example, the idea of sharing and of common right seems to have been within the culture for some time, well before open field farming took a firm hold, probably way, way, way back. But one source of solid written evidence comes as early as Ina of Wessex and his late 7th century law. Do you want to hear a late 7th century law article? We have heard about Ina before anyway, so here's the law in question. If peasants have a common paddock or other shared land to fence, and some have fenced their part, some haven't, and animals have eaten their common fields or grass, then those who are responsible for the gap should go and make amends to the others who have fenced their part for the damage that has been done there. They should seek from livestock such justice for themselves as is appropriate. This law tells us by implication that by this time, late 7th century, churls already might hold land in common, or they might share the land, hold parcels of it. If they didn't, why would you need to have a law about it? A grass enclosure is the type of land most likely to be involved in common, but it could also be arable. The peasants evidently do not work together on fencing. Everyone is responsible for their own little bit. Nor is it clear if cultivation of the land is cooperative. They're just fencing bits of it. It therefore makes the point to us that common rights are not dependent on open field farming. They existed independently and previously. So conversely, the enclosure movement, enclosing land again from the 15th century onwards, which we will hear about, and you've probably heard about in the history of England, does not necessarily mean ending rights of common, although often, it has to be said, it does. What I'm saying is, essentially open fields and common rights are not the same thing, it's just that common rights are usually needed to make open field systems work. However, there is no doubt that the open field system required a high degree of cooperation and collaboration. It needed people to get together to design planting schemes, agree harvesting times, and critically, making sure no one took too much from the common rights. In the Anglo-Saxon world, these issues get resolved in public institutions, not private manors as they will in the Norman world. They might be connected with the tuneship we talked about. Common farming relied very heavily on people getting together and planning and working things out together. For larger issues and disputes, it is the Hundred Court of Moot, which is the forum. The laws of Edward the Confessor in the 11th century talk about the moot bell, rang to gather together all who in English are called the folk gemot. These are places like the Chilworth Tree in the Benson Lowlands we talked about some time ago, and there the tithings and aldermen and the reeves would gather and thrash the issues out. Ina's 17th century law mentions common issues of law, such as fences not being repaired, overgrazing, livestock being allowed to escape and damage to crops, all that sort of thing. The spread of open field farming between the 9th and 13th centuries changed the way our countryside looked, and you can still see the legacy as you walk around. It spawned an entire vocab, much of which is now forgotten, but some of it can still appear in local place names. A Celian was a curved S strip, so shaped as the plough veered to the left to prepare for the turn. There's a lovely picture of that on a snowy field on page 38 in the PDFs. There's the headland, a section of field where the plough would turn, furlongs for collection of strips within each field. A gore was a wedge-shaped piece of land caused by the distressingly uneven and non-rectangular character of nature. There is just one surviving open field system left in England. It is at Laxton in Nottinghamshire, where I believe there is still also a manorial court or court leet. It was all up for sale recently. I had a look at the money box. Sadly, couldn't quite make it. It is still quite easy in many places, actually, to see the marks of the open field. The easiest are those fields, often a pasture, which have been unploughed since enclosure. You can often see the bumps of the old ridge and furrow in the grass. They are now, I believe, protected by law. In our South Oxfordshire example, the wide open plain below the Scarp was most suitable for open field farming, and it predominated there. So, in Lucknow, for example, which is a parish partly at the foot of the Scarp, there survives a 16th century estate map of the open fields, showing the open fields and the areas of field owned by All Souls College, Oxford. Equally, for the alternative type of countryside, on the dip slope over the far end of the old Benson estate by a Henley, there's a map of 1585 which shows the traditional enclosed field structure of Harpston, ancient countryside. Both those images are in the PDFs on the website, pages 37 and 43 respectively, so please go and have a look. The area around Benson was also perfectly designed for a planned open field system. It's dominated by heavy clay, fertile but needing heavy ploughs and lots of labour. In the 8th century, the layout seems to still have been pretty traditional, with a basic separation between outfields of pasture and infields of arable, plenty of small private fields called closes. Eventually, this will become a vast single field of 2,500 acres worked in strips. Now look, that might be small in, I don't know, Oklahoma, but it's massive here. I am told that if you are to eat an elephant, then it makes sense to eat it in chunks. And the same happens if you're creating an elephant of an open field. So the transformation probably didn't happen overnight. It happened in chunks over centuries, probably accelerated when Norman landlords arrived and pushed change harder and with a bit more brutality. Benson is a great example. If you happen to be in the area, stand on the top of Howe Hill and look down to Britwell Salome over the plains, and you can see an example in all its glory. Vast fields even now, despite its division by thin, weedy, straight enclosure hedges of the early 19th century. The question, I suppose, then might be, what benefits and impacts did all these changes have on wealth, life and agricultural efficiency and that sort of thing? Well, it is quite difficult to be precise about all of that and how far it led to increased production. Historians worry awfully about this, and it is certainly difficult to see a massive uplift. But then the evidence is difficult, you've got to understand. It's distant, it's hidden. Much of it, after all, has been eaten off. What's clear is that the change is piecemeal. It doesn't happen everywhere, as I said, and according to local decisions and circumstances, it might vary a lot. Churls, peasants, reeves, local lords, they weren't idiots. They knew what their land was like and what it could do. They changed their circumstances only when they were convinced it would bring a benefit. So, for example, although the land above the Chiltern Scarp in Harpston, as I've just mentioned, never went for open fields, there were places above the Scarp where they did. So, in the little village of Cookley Green, just down the road from me, the vast majority of the countryside is unplanned, small fields and enclosures, classic ancient stuff. But there were two big open fields at one stage on the most productive, flattest land, though they were gone by 1609. It's also really important never to forget the idea of local differences. And by local, I mean farm to farm, village to village, not just region to region. You know, like the Cookley Green example I've just given you, bits and bobs here and there. A more common arrangement than simply monolithic open fields would have been a flexible infield-outfield system, reflecting the characteristics of different fields and land. I think I've described that process before. The land nearest the settlement cultivated every year, manured regularly, outfield taken into cultivation as required, and returned to pasture when fertility declines. Some individual areas in an estate might be kept outside the big open fields to reflect the local conditions. Some waterlogged ground, for example. So we have some fields on an area that used to be called Lashmira, or boggy ground. Or areas where certain crops struggle because it might catch the prevailing wind coming up the valley, so it couldn't be used for young stock, for example. Considerations like this would always remain important, so we can't impose uniformity for the sake of a neat story, sad though that is. Local variety therefore remained to maximise success, and I might also point out that control over landscape was more limited than it is now. I think I've said this before, a couple of times maybe, sorry to repeat myself. Fertilisers, chemicals, machinery, modified seeds didn't exist back then. So, the lives of ordinary people were much more deeply affected by their environment than we are now. Specialisation on a regional basis comes much later to England than our period. So the vast majorities of families and estates produced for a sort of subsistence plus. They produced all they needed to eat and then tried to produce a surplus in good years when they could for cash. This is rather than, say, specialising in wheat across most of the estate and buying your meat in from elsewhere, or raising sheep and buying the grain and fodder you needed. This is simply because supply of anything you might need is just not reliable enough in Anglo-Saxon England in an unsophisticated, poorly integrated economy. Sorry to be harsh, but that's the way it is. And cash is not deeply embedded. I hope Anglo-Saxon England is not hurt. However, within estates, there would, of course, be enough specialisation, just again to make the point, to maximise the use of land. So we have spoken about this before. Bickerton as a village for beekeeping, Swinkham possibly a place for keeping pigs. While I'm on pigs, I need to have a quick digression. Brief one, if you don't mind, about one of God's more wonderful animals, the versatile and thoroughly adorable piggy. One of the better known and often repeated facts about medieval farming is the thing about common rights of pannage, the right to take your pigs to the woods to fatten them up on acorns or beech mast. And the Chilterns are traditionally an area of beechwood, although probably not as far back as Anglo-Saxon times, to be fair. But it is easy to overdo how important pannage would have been. Oliver Rackham points out that such acorn and beech crops tend to be very unreliable year to year. So pannage would have been no more than a top-up, a little extra at a particular time of year. You couldn't rely on it. Most of the time, the swineherd would need to produce fodder for the pigs or use fallow field, a much more reliable resource. Anyway, by way of illumination of the life of the swineherd and another way of comparing life of the free churl and the inland peasant, here are the arrangements on Bath Abbey for swineherds, firstly on warland. It befits the tenant swineherd that he give his animals for slaughter according to the custom that stands on the estate, that he gives each year 15 pigs for slaughter, 10 mature and 5 young. He has for himself any that he rears over that. Also, the duty of the swineherd is that he sends slaughtered pigs well prepared after their slaughter. Then he will be full well worth his perquisites. He must be ready all the while to work and horsed for the Lord's needs. So that's the warland. This is a very different situation to the unfree swineherd of the inland. The inland peasant gets far fewer goodies. He simply raises his Lord's herd and then gets back a bit of a sweetener as a thank you for raising them. To the bound swineherd, who holds the Lord's drift, is due a little pig, and his perquisites when he has prepared the bacon, and all other rights which pertain to bound men. Just to give you a bit of a word of the week moment, the Gobbet uses the word drift as the process under forest law of driving animals through the forest to establish a right of way. If you're thinking of establishing a new right of way somewhere, you might want to get some pigs together. You might also come across roads called drift or the drift, which are often drovers' roads for moving animals. There is a nice little back way near Windsor I used to use when I was young and thrusting, a lovely straight, wide, largely unused road down which I could hurtle while carefully observing the speed limits, of course. So where are we? We're just emerging from a bit of a double digression about the noble pigwiggin and the lives of swineherds. So overall then, back to the knitting. Despite the difficulty of the evidence for increased output, we can cautiously conclude that the impact of the growth of open field systems was in all likelihood to increase the emphasis on arable production in those areas it was adopted, and a more intensive way of going about it. And across England as a whole, then, arable production is likely to have increased considerably. In terms of impact, the other major change, though, concerned settlement patterns and the emergence in champion land of good old traditional English villages, a feature of the landscape which kind of seems inevitable in a way, but which is in fact not. By the village, I am probably guilty of loose language. So what I'm talking about here is a clearly nucleated village which has one defined centre, usually grouped around church and manor house. So the last time we spoke specifically about settlement patterns, I was talking about individual scattered farm settlements being the standard Hyde-Fard sort of thing, farms all over the landscape. And to this, we have added the emergence of the new lords of the manor from the fissioning of large multiple estates with their hall, court, church and outbuildings in a centre enclosed by a stockade. So outside that stockaded lord's centre, buildings may have begun to gather together independently of open field systems, but they'd have done so in a very straggly, organic, random, unplanned sort of way. So, for example, one historian talked of the interrupted row as a common feature of settlement. That's where farms had been established quite close to each other and therefore kind of formed a sort of street, but there were large gaps between each farm. Settlements might also be polyfocal, which is a very highfalutin way of saying they had no really defined single centre, but existed in a series of nearby clusters. Now, with the impact of an open field systems, those settlements began to cluster together around the lord's enclosure, much closer together in a more planned way. Because this maximised space, it allowed the development of the largest possible open fields. It made it easier to share the resources of the plough or gather together to bring in the harvest at times of year. And as villages became better and more closely defined, in some cases they would then split, especially if they had originally been polyfocal. In this sometimes lies the genesis of one of the features of English place names, the great and the little thing, as in memorably great snoring and little snoring. Peatling Magna and Peatling Parva is another, or East and West kind of thing, so East Grinstead, West Grinstead. Nor was that all. Since lords were demanding more and production was intensifying, settlement intensifies as well, so entirely new villages begin to appear during the period. Often the start might be around some existing building around which they cluster to create the new village, irrespective of the advance of open field systems, or to fulfil some sort of agricultural practice. I have a nice example of this from Kent. So, the Weald of Kent in the very southeast corner of England, Garden of England they used to call it, where lives Disgusted of Tunbridge Wells. Kent is very uppy and it's also very downy. So it's uppy and downy with the characteristics of ancient countryside, very much so. And it was part of a very wooded area at the time. There's still quite a lot of woodland there. Part of its agricultural tradition was the rearing of pigs. So pigs had traditionally been driven in the autumn to the southwest of the county to feed on beech mast and acorns. While they did that, the drovers would use temporary settlements they just banged up in the same spirit as temporary highland settlements in, I don't know, in the Alps, or like the ones I met on a walking holiday in the Cantabrians in northern Spain, or indeed like the Shielings of Northumbria. In Kent, these temporary settlements can often be identified by the suffix den, which gives you a good idea of the dangers of place names, since we introduced the den suffix previously as a narrow valley. Context is all. Now, these temporary Kentish settlements, places like Tenterden, for example, began to become permanent rather than a seasonal thing as population grew and agriculture intensified. So they began also to bring some land under cultivation. The same process happened in Cornwall and the Lake District, where shealings occupied in the summer pasture areas gradually became permanent farmsteads instead, and so settlements spread and grew. Now, you might ask, and it would be a good question, what the process was by which the changes were implemented. So in my little sketchette earlier, I presented the original idea as a sort of chat between peasants. Now, you may scoff at this, for sure, you might say, based on the not unreasonable notion that this is an increasingly seigneurial society we've been describing. So, look, surely it would have been forced on people by the newly resident lords intensifying production. But you would be at least partly wrong to so think. In many places, these decisions to implement a new system and remodel the settlement may very well have been made together by a large number of villagers, Yeniats, Costetlan, Bordars. I hope in the section on Warland I show that throughout the Anglo-Saxon and medieval periods, there remained a significant community of free peasants acting with independence as part of a broader community and state. However, where this does happen, it was most likely that a few well-off peasants, owning most of the land in the area, they got together and agreed what would happen. The idea of the whole community meeting, probably reasonably rare. The smaller were most likely pulled along by the richer. Also, there were plenty of places where there was still no resident manorial lord. Some of these can be identified probably by place names, so Charlton, for example, is a reasonably common name. It's derived from churl's tun, or peasant's settlement. So in these places, decisions would perforce be driven by the villagers themselves. This more organic and bottom-up approach was probably often reflected also in the way that the village settlements came together. So one of the features of the early medieval villages had been the walking village, which is a rather delightful and thoroughly convincing model. Hear me out. So look, houses were made of wood. Wood rotted quite quickly. So let's say you're a poor Bordar or Yibor living on a toft with a tiny little wee small cottage and a patch of land out back. Rather than repair the house as it rotted, having to rebuild the whole darned thing, you'd just leave it to fall down, and you'd build a new one at the end of the row of tofts. And so over time, as that kept on happening, the village effectively walked down the road. But where settlements now had a lordly centre, where now they had an incentive not to invade the shared land of the open fields, you couldn't just nibble bits off, that process now becomes rarer. You'd instead either infill between the interrupted rows or rebuild your toft and villagers stop walking. So, having said a word in favour of the existence of peasant action, you are quite right. The most common model was probably indeed driven from above by the lord. There was plenty of incentive for the lord to reorganise their manors where they could if the open field was indeed the most efficient form of agricultural organisation. You would then, of course, be maximising the return from your own domain. Why would you not? Silly not to. The domain being, just to remind you, the land held directly by the lord and worked by his estate workers rather than being rented out. So where the process was driven by the lord, the domain land would be distributed among the strips in the open fields, just like any of the villagers. Very equitable, though you can bet the lord's strips would be the best land of all, life being what it is. It was in the lord's interest, of course, to promote the latest and most efficient agricultural improvements. If your tenants were doing a bit better, well then, they would be more likely to use your market, your mills. They could afford a bit more rent when the lease came up again in three lifetimes. Slightly more nebulously, reorganising the village allowed a landlord more control over the tenants because they were all in the same place, they were easy to get to, they were close under the eagle eye of the manorial Barra de Dour and its reeve. So, it helped their reeves monitor the work of the peasants and the delivery of their dues and their work, and you knew where to get them. In some cases, once the open field was implemented, the development of the settlement could be a bit-by-bit process, a change here, a new toft there. In others, a new village could be developed in a very structured process, all in one go. The lord might lay out a new area of land with identically sized tofts and tenements, with a small cottage with a long, thin patch of land stretching out behind. It might then be an enforced move, all the workers hoiked off to the settlements, those with the same terms and condition of tenancy all put together in one place to live side by side. Or they might even move villages and settlements lock, stock and, potentially, smoking barrel. In our Benson Shear, it looks as though the little village of Newington may well have been created specifically as a completely new settlement, moving churls from their small farms and hamlets into one central place. As it happens, our areas of South Oxfordshire are also a good place to see the nucleated village of the planned countryside, so I have selected the absolutely stonkingly beautiful village of Ewelme for you if you would like to have a look, including images from the Googly Maps thing in the PDF on the website again, pages 39 to 42. It has a classic nucleated village structure, though it's quite complicated because it's quite a large place, and I have included a picture of the gorgeous chapel and Alice Djorsa's tomb. Ewelme was the caput of the Earls and Dukes of Suffolk much later on, and so it had some fantastic buildings, some of which are no longer there, but some of which are. Henry and I did a quick vid of the place on YouTube, and I'll put a link to the episode there so you can see me talking about the history of the place. And then, if you are feeling even more industrious, you can compare that to the Manor of Swinkham, just up the hill. And there, you can find the central elements of the Thanes estate. Farm, house, church, but that's your lot for nucleation. Individual farms are then scattered all around in small hamlets. This is ancient countryside. You can have a look at those on slides 43 and 44. So look, that is basically it for this episode, but one more point about the impact of all of this. There will emerge a much later theory from David Underdown, the historian, which is worth mentioning here, I think. It related to the 17th century Civil War period. You might well ask what on earth I'm doing talking about something that much later than Anglo-Saxon England, but I will try to make it relevant, promise. David Underdown's thesis was that in Western England, communities tended to react differently to the call from King and from Parliament, and his rather attractive idea is that they might have had something to do with settlement patterns and ways of life in different areas. So, in the ancient, unplanned countryside with dispersed settlement, wood pasture, more pastoral type of agriculture, Underdown saw a greater adherence to the parliamentary cause. Now, he figured this might have something to do with the dispersed nature of settlement, the more individual nature of life, these small independent farms organising themselves and looking after their own households and their subsistence. That might have encouraged nonconformist religion, less deference to a more distant lord, less reliance on collaborative working with fellow villagers who were then further away and less frequently seen. And anyway, you weren't involved in all that heavy arable farming type stuff. You were looking after livestock mainly. So conversely, set against that, the nucleated villages of the plains, focused on arable agriculture, encouraged a different type of culture. Much more collaborative, working together was essential to success. There was a greater opportunity to get together more often, more of life was focused on the church and the local community. Also, the Lord was right by and closer, and therefore maybe deference was stronger and more embedded. It was a more conservative approach to life. So in the Civil Wars, these places tended to prefer the royalist course. So look, I advanced that idea to you about one possible impact of the planned countryside arrival and this transformation that we've talked about today. Going back to the start, historians have rejected the idea that the nucleation and planned countryside arose from cultural reasons, instead emphasising economic and social changes as the causes of it. But it may be instead that these changes generated cultural change where they occurred. Okie dokie then. I hope you've enjoyed that, and I have to say we are now very, very close to the end of Series 2 of the Anglo-Saxon England podcast, and I have no idea if there will ever be a new series. We do at least have one more to go, which is all about the Norman Conquest. One of the big questions I raised at the start was whether or not the conquest brought fundamental social changes to Anglo-Saxon England, or whether it was just a change of land ownership, a change of boss, basically. And that is what we will discuss next time. Until then, everyone, thank you very much for listening. And do remember to come along to the website and thehistoryofengland.co.uk to snaffle up all those goodies I kept banging on about this week. And remember, you can also become members, get these podcasts and the History of England podcasts advert-free. Plus, loads of extra shedcasts, over 100 hours of podcasts. Anyway, until next time then, good luck everyone and have a wonderful time.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at Ashley.com. Ashley. For the love of home.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.